This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita!
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I text my coach saying this was when I was due to do Liège. It's my Liège best on Liège under 23. It's my first race of the year. And I was like, oh, awesome. I've got 5 weeks till this. I can get down to a really lightweight. And I got a phone call about 2 minutes later and got an absolute bollocking. He was like, no, like, stop thinking about weight. You're still 20. If you start sacrificing weight now and going all in, you're going to stunt your growth, your performance, your development. It was don't be an idiot.
Hello and welcome to Faster, the Dr. Hutch podcast, supported by Cycling Weekly. I'm Michael Hutchinson, often known as Dr. Hutch, and I'm a former pro cyclist and a national time trial champion. This time, I'm talking to British under 23 rider Joe Laverick. I'm talking to Joe because I want to hear about what it takes to make it from that crowded, ambitious under 23 category into the professional ranks. Joe's currently based in Girona, along with more or less every other bike racer in the world, and he rides for the Hagens Berman Axion team. That's the outfit founded by Axel Merckx, and it's probably the most successful rider development team in the world. As well as the dangers of obsessing over body weight that you already heard about, we talked about lifestyle.
I very much believe nobody's perfect, but if you kind of live on the whole 80%, 20% balance, or 85, 15, whatever, within 85% you eat well and you live well, 15% you have a life, that's a good way of, again, staying sane.
We talked about time trial technology and the price of going faster.
I'm on arguably one of the top three fastest bikes in the world, but I haven't been wind tunnel tested, and I know in my head I'm giving watts away, but the only other way of doing it is kind of investing £800, whatever, and we might have two TTs in a year. That could be like for 30k's worth of time trialing. And it's just balancing that up. Like, if I was World Tour, I'd do it. But at the minute, I just can't afford it. And that, it kind of frustrates me. Well, it does frustrate me a lot.
And Alex Dowsett, from the Israel Startup Nation team, who's an alumnus of the Axion team, joined in to tell me about what World Tour teams are looking for in new riders these days.
Right now, in World Tour teams, children are fashionable. Like, every team wants the next 14-year-old that can do 7 watts per kilo for 20 minutes.
The reason I wanted to talk to you, Joe, I mean, I've talked to a few people for this podcast, and the thing that interests me is that you're at the other end of your career from a lot of the guys I have to. I mean, I think the last big road rider I talked to was Steve Cummings, who retired a couple of years ago. If you talk to Steve, it's very much, Steve, tell me about those tour stages you want. How did you do that? You're at a key point as a developing rider, in that you're just at that point where you're transitioning from being kind of a junior into first couple of years senior to looking for a pro contract. It's that kind of stepping stone. So while part of what all this is about is what you've already done and how you achieved that, I think it's at least as much about where you're going next and how you get there. So kind of the job interview question, maybe is appropriate, which is, where do you see yourself in 5 or 6 years? Where are you going? Where are you heading?
In 5 or 6 years, I'd be 25, 26, which at the minute in cycling is quite old, isn't it? When you look at Lunin Pogačar and all the guys who are winning at the minute. Like, personally, I'd see myself in the World Tour. I know I'm not, like, physically, I know I'm not a Van der Poel or a Remco or whatever. But there's still jobs in the World Tour to be done. And there's still those guys who, you just mentioned Steve, he was never the most talented rider in the peloton, but and I'm sure he won't mind me saying that, but he still managed to use his brain to do a job and get some ridiculous stage wins. It's like that stage when, I can't remember what year of the tour it was, but when he kind of outfoxed both Pino and Bardet.
Oh, it was 2015. That was the airfield at Mende, yeah.
Yeah, that was incredible. And it's guys like that, or things like you see Dalsit Giro stage last year. Again, Alex will say himself, he wasn't the strongest rider in that Giro. But there's always opportunities. And yeah, the World Tour is the ultimate goal. I've got two more years under 23. And I feel I'm in a pretty good position at the team I'm at with the calendar we've got.
Even for a rider with talent, focus and motivation, getting from the under 23 category to that first World Tour contract is very hard. And if anything, it's getting harder because what the World Tour teams want seems to be changing. I thought it might be useful to get some context from Alex Dowsett, who used to ride for the team Joe's in now. Alex has been a World Tour rider for a decade now, with stage wins at the Giro d'Italia and almost as many national time trial titles as me. I asked him about what the teams are looking for and what they base their signing decisions on.
The reason for the such heavy focus on numbers is the lack of racing for under-23s. Like, if we think we were hard done by in the pro ranks last year with the lack of racing, it was far, far worse for every level underneath the World Tour. What did the under-23s and the youngsters have? They resorted to simple power outputs, and that's all they had. And sort of alongside that, team suddenly, because there is all this data, and data is it's very black and white. So when Joe won the GHS, I got in touch, and I think Joe was the first rider since myself to win it as and not in the oldest category, 1 year below. So we started talking, and I was like, if you need any help, let me know. And subsequently worked with Joe since then for the last kind of 5 or 6 years as a mentor, I guess, sometimes a coach, but mostly a mentor. I remember Joe coming into his like first or second year under 23. He's like, I've got to get a pro contract. I've got to get, like, there was so much pressure. I was like, Joe, it took me 4 years in the under 23s to get a pro contract. And that was fine. But like now it has changed and teams are picking up. Remco has set a dangerous precedent where teams think there's going to be a Remco every single year and they'll just pluck them straight out of juniors and they'll go and win every straight stage race they enter. But it's just not the case. And teams, I think, are looking at data to support their argument for this. And I heard a wicked story recently where a team tested out a junior who posted some mind-blowing numbers, signed him up for 3 years on some obscene contract, and then realized the power meter was overreading.
So as in, what kind of rider are you heading towards being? I mean, I'll admit I kind of tend to think of you a bit as a time trialist, which maybe isn't quite fair, since time trial specialism is it's quite a narrow specialism. Maybe you're looking at something broader than that.
So coming through the junior ranks, without that, I was a time trialist, but I grew up on the British club scene. My first ever race was a 9-point-something mile TT, the Fonaby One lap in Lincolnshire.
It's sound. Yeah, I approve of that.
It's one of those courses. I think I did like a long 27 on it and thought it was really good. And now I've got the course record of like, I don't know, maybe a short 18 or something. So I've got progress.
It's really nice to be able to see things like that. It's one of the nice things about having some sort of a time trial background is that, particularly coming through as a junior, when you're growing up, you can see yourself making progress every month. It is quite nice. But sorry, I'm distracting you.
I can go all day on time trialing. Just like my local club 10, I did a 19 dead on it 2 years ago. I haven't been back since, and it killed me that I didn't do an 18:59. But anyway, I digress.
Yeah, where are you going next? We'll do a whole time trialing appendix at the end of it as a sort of a nerd special.
So I won a few races on the continent as a junior. Like my kind of party line is I actually rolled Remco and Van Poel in a TT at juniors. Won a UCI TT and then went to Worlds and top 10 there. So I was very much seen as this time trialist. In fact, I think, I don't know if I still do, but I did have the fastest ever 10 mile TT time as a junior, as a 16 year old, sorry. Don't know if I do. It doesn't really matter.
I'm not nerd enough to know off the top of my head, sorry.
Long and short of it, I was always seen as a time trialist. And then I went on to Madison, and we didn't really have that many time trials in the calendar. And then the same last year on Agi d'Azur, and I kind of realized, given my physiology, I'm 66, 65 kilos, depending on where I am in season. If you want to be an out-and-out TT specialist, most of the guys are a lot heavier. Look at Ghana, he's in the 80s. And I'm not saying I can't do a good time trial, because I can, but I don't want to put myself in that box as a specialist.
That's fair enough. So you're kind of looking at heading towards the classics or World of GC or humble water carrier?
All of the above. Now, that's people's first assumption. When they say you're a time trialist and you don't want to do that as much anymore, it's like, oh, you go do the classics then. And to be fair, I see myself in kind of like the medium mountains. That's where I think I go best. Not out-and-out watts per kilo efforts. I'm never going to win a competition against someone who's 55 kilos. But those kind of breakaway days, and I can do a job in the mountains for the team. I'm not going to win the tour, but I can win a stage kind of thing.
Yeah, so, you know, I think, for me talking to you, Joe, I think the biggest single question I've got is how you reconcile, you know where you're going, you know where you're trying to get to, is how you reconcile your kind of long-term development as, you know, looking down to the next 5-6 years, how you reconcile that with your short-term development, because you've got kind of long-term targets, but you've also got some pretty harsh short-term targets in terms of getting a contract, getting the next step up the ladder, and that those aren't always going to pull in the same direction. So how do you reconcile those?
The short-term, well, there's obviously so many targets. The short-term is in the next 2 years, that's get a pro deal. It's no secret when you come out of under 23s that it's not impossible to go pro, but it's very, very, very difficult. It's like Matt Holmes, who was my teammate on Madison Genesis. I think he was 25 when he went pro with Lotto, and that was seen as very late. So short to midterm is just, it's all about getting that contract and how you do that. And it's just, it's doing a job in those races. So my first race this year, my first race block is in Portugal. And for me, at Volta Algarve, which is a point pro, I'm not going to win that on GC. It's just, it's a fact I'm not. I think looking at the past winners, Geraint Thomas has won it, Kwiatkowski. The last 5 or 6 years just is like a who's who of Tour de France winners. But if I can get in a break or nick a jersey one day, then that's the sort of thing which a team will go, oh, look, he can do this.
The under 23 category is about more than just attracting the attention of World Tour team directors. When I talked to Alex Dowsett, he made a really important point about its role in developing riders.
Like when I was younger, every team had a Colombian. Like the Colombians were the overpriced Colombians were the next big thing. Quintana and had set, like Quintana was the Remco of that generation, where suddenly every team was scrambling around for a Colombian. And now the same thing I feel has happened, but it's for kids straight out of juniors. But I think under 23s not doing that racing is dangerous, because that's kind of what crafts you as a racer. And there are some cases of some guys having all the numbers in the world, but cannot string together a real world bike race.
Let's put it this way, Joe. If you'd got a contract now, if someone had come on board, and as happens occasionally, and said, right, we're not going to sign you now, but we will sign you next year. We'll sign you onto a kind of 3-year contract. If you looked down the year and said, right, I've got the next 4 years is secure. I don't need to worry about becoming pro. Don't need to worry about making a living. Would what you do in terms of training, in terms of how you're trying to condition yourself, would that be different from how it's going to be this year, where you feel you've got a much smaller window to make an impression?
No, I don't think it would be, because the thing is, at the minute, as an under 23, if you want to go pro, you've already got to live the pro lifestyle. The level's so high. So my training at the minute is kind of prepping for those 5-6 hour races, which I haven't had in the past. And that'd be the same if I was to sign this hypothetical deal. Odd things might change, but I think as a whole, if you're not already living a pretty professional lifestyle, if you're going to call it that, you've got no chance because the level as an under 23 is so high. We've got guys like my teammates, myself, living almost a world tour lifestyle already just without the paycheck.
I mean, one of the things that I did wonder about is you've written a little bit about weight as a body weight as a sort of a thing cycling has problems with, and you know, I wonder if that's something that filters down more, becomes an even more pressured issue at under 23 level, because it's such a punch up to get to the next. I mean, I know the old Jimmy Sean Yates telling me that when he signed for his first French development team, the first meeting he was given two jerseys, two pairs of shorts. The guy said, lose 5 kilos, never attack into a headwind. The next guy came along and he got two jerseys, two pairs of shorts, was told to lose 5 kilos and never to attack into a headwind. And that was the entire kind of performance advice from the team. Lose 5 kilos, don't attack into a headwind. And I, you know, cycling, I think World Tour still has quite a lot of that, particularly Italian teams, maybe Spanish teams. Is that drive all the way down to under 23? I would worry that at under 23 it might be even worse because you're dealing with a kind of a much more feral environment.
It depends where, as you touched on. So I was in France last year with the As You Deserve Devo squad, and I was told I could lose a figure which equated to just below 10% of my body mass, and have the same time trial ability, which common sense just says no. And I saw guys on that team last year get very light, very, very light. But then an injury came across 3 weeks later. So they were flying for 3 weeks, but then they couldn't race for a month. And I'm not saying that they were directly related, but I mean, you presume there's something to do with it. I think it depends. So on Axion, the team aren't pressurizing you at all. So I work with like my own nutritionist in the background, and I'm not perfect. Like writing that article for Cycling Weekly, it hit home. Like a fair few things I was writing of like how not to do it. I was like, I've done this, and I still do this. Like at the minute, I'm not trying to lose loads of kilos, but say I've got Algarve in a month, I need to be at race weight. And I think with any elite athlete in any elite sport, there's got to be some sort of disordered behavior. Otherwise, you're just not going to make it. It's like it's not normal to sit in your garage on a TT bike for 3 hours staring at a wall, but we still do.
Yeah, I think there's something. I think there's something, almost something wrong with any elite athlete.
100%. And
I said that to a sports psychologist I know, and she said, yes, but what's interesting is how some of them deal with that better than others. You almost take it as read that if someone is an elite athlete has got a defect of some sort that makes them like that, but it's how they then cope with it from then on in.
Yeah, and I think the thing is in under 23s is we're a lot more impressionable. So if a World Tour DS said to me, yeah, I'll sign you, but I expect when you turn up on January the 1st, you're 4 kilos lighter. I'm going to lose those 4 kilos because a World Tour DS who I'm trying to impress has said that. You've just almost got to cross your fingers and hope that the people who you're working under have an understanding and a respect, because, I mean, there are times where you've got to lose weight. I mean, it's part and parcel of the job. Watts per kilo makes you go fast uphill. But then there's that finding that fine balance, and you just hope that you're dealing with someone who understands that watts are just important as like a low kilo. So it's just hoping, and it's so different between different teams.
No, I mean, it has been like that kind of since forever, but I think, I mean, from what I see, I think it has got better, but you know, like you say, in the end of the day, it's a performance sport, and the big sort outs get made going up hills for the most part, and weight is part of that.
Yeah, exactly. I got a phone call. I text my coach saying this was when I was due to do Liège, as my Liège Bastogne Liège under 23 is my first race of the year, and I was like, oh, awesome. I've got 5 weeks till this. I can get down to a really lightweight. And I got a phone call about 2 minutes later and got an absolute bollocking. He was like, no, like stop thinking about weight. You're still 20. If you start sacrificing weight now and going all in, you're going to stunt your growth, your performance, your development. It was don't be an idiot. having someone like that on your shoulder is good, because if I'd have had an old school coach, it could have been like, oh yeah, great idea.
For riders in their late teens and early 20s, the balance between body weight, training load, recovery, and still hitting those critical performance targets is a very, very delicate one. I asked Joe about his current priorities.
I don't have, or I haven't had in the past, many 5+ hour races, and I need to be good at kind of, I can do good power fresh and I can do good power fatigue now, but at the start of winter, my fatigue resistance wasn't as high. And for me, I go really well off big hours. So that's all basically all I'm doing at the minute. I think I've got 6 hours tomorrow, then a rest day, and then another 6 hour ride.
Yeah, I looked at your Strava as part of my preparation for chatting to you. I noticed, yeah, the last few weeks you've done, there's been kind of 23, 24, 25 hour weeks in there, which is kind of, it's kind of world tour training mileage, isn't it?
Yeah, again, you've got to do it. And if, like, it's interesting, if I changed coach this winter, and if you look at my 7 day blocks, they're not all big, but like, as I'm kind basically a full-time bike rider, I don't work in Monday to Sunday kind of blocks. And that's another thing my coach has got me into thinking, because I, like everyone, go on Strava and I think, oh, I've done 23 hours this week. But my 7 day thing could be 30. And it's just little things like that I've got to wrap my head around. But yeah, it's endurance. I go well off the endurance box, so why wouldn't I do it?
Yeah, no, fair enough. I mean, one of the things that, my career is not kind of a typical career of a world tour pro, and that I was kind of a British domestic pro who specialized in time trialing and came to it late. So these things don't necessarily transfer across. But one of the things I would change if I was going back to start it all again is that I'd be much more cautious about increasing training load. This is because the thing is, every time you increase the training load, you get a little bit of a gain from it. So when you move from doing 16 hours a week to 18 hours a week, you get a little bit of a gain. And my kind of thinking about it now was that if you went from 16 hours to 18 hours a week, you get a gain. Then you go to 18 hours to 20 hours and you get another gain. But I worried if you go from 16 hours to 20 hours, you don't get both of those gains. You get less than that. And I know, I wonder a little bit what your take on this issue, whether that's just blunting the training response by ramping things up really quickly. I appreciate you come at it from the other end because you've got five-hour race days coming up where you need to be ready for that. But again, this is part of a rider development question, really, and you're in the middle of it, and it's not always easy.
Well, I'm third year under 23 now. And as I said, guys like Pogačar, they're winning the Tour, and they're 2 years older than me. I feel I was lucky in a way that my first year under 23, I was still doing A-levels because of how my birthday falls. So that actually almost stunted the amount of training I could do in a week because I was in school pretty much full time. I mean, I got a bit of leeway. In fact, I had really bad attendance in my final year. But training load, it was nowhere near what I was doing now. And then last year in France, I did decent training. But I feel because I was still in school as a first year, I've had to lay back. Whereas there's guys now who are full-time cyclists as juniors and doing 20, 25 hour weeks. And I completely agree with you. If you're doing 20, 25 hour weeks at age 17 as a second year junior, where do you go when you're under 23 or World Tour? Like, you've already reached your ceiling. You can't do 35 hour weeks.
Yeah, because I ramped things up really, really quickly to 25, 30 hours a week. And that's all the time there is. You can't do more than that. And I worry a little, not worry too strong because it's not my problem. But, you know, I would be concerned if I were coaching someone as a junior or even kind of as an 18, 19 year old who was immediately ramped. And it's very tempting to do it because that's what the pros do and that's what you want to do. And you will get a gain from it, but it's where you go next. And it's also, does it produce injury problems? Does it produce weight problems?
I think at my age now, I mean, I know I'm young as opposed to like the world as a whole, but as my cycling age, I think I'm almost that borderline pro age. So say this time next year or this time in 2 years, I could have a World Tour deal, for example. And if you can't just completely go up or you won't be at the level. But I'm very much with you on the fact that junior riders doing 20 plus hour weeks is absolutely absurd. Like, I don't see, I believe you should get GCSEs and A levels and then go on to cycling. because university, I didn't go to uni. I'm not at uni, and I feel I can, I've got the A-level results, I can go back. But if I went full-time cycling after my GCSEs, it's like I've got nothing to fall back on.
I think teams nowadays are much better equipped to support riders that come straight in without the prior experience of how to be a bike rider. I know, like, the contrast between my time at Movistar, where it really was like, here's your race program, turn up fit and kind of leave you to it. And I think things have changed there now, but that was certainly the case back then. Whereas like teams like Jumbo Visma and Sky, they have all the necessary protocols and support in place to support these youngsters. The fear in my mind, or the issue, is the fact that what I did as an under 23, that making mistakes, learning how to be a bike rider, has now been shifted to junior level. And that's then going to affect these kids' education, because they're like, well, if I want to turn pro when I turn 18, I need to not be doing school, because that's not going to help me. I think that could be a negative knock-on effect, and maybe just taking the fun out of it. I wonder if we'll see, because starting the careers early, 34, 35, which is when on average a pro ends his career, is that then going to shift to 31, 32? Maybe out of choice of the cyclist, but actually the choice of the team, just going, like, you're too old.
So it must be quite difficult to figure out whether it's improvement because you're doing more training, or you're doing different training, or if you hadn't changed anything at all, would you just have got better through just getting a bit older, the hormones changing, muscles maturing?
Yeah, I have this conversation a lot with my friends, like my friends similar age in the sport, because we all do similar, but this is really contradictory, but similar but very different training.
Yeah, you're gonna have to talk me through this.
So we all do similar amount of hours, like kind of have a similar lifestyle, but what we do in those hours can be quite different, or we do them in different training periods, whatever. But we all end up as much for muchness as we were when we were juniors. Like obviously we kick on a little bit more, and we're now racing at higher level. But so there's two other guys I'm thinking of that I race with at juniors. We're all kind of about the same ability in comparison to each other as we were when we were 17, 18, so 3 or 4 years ago. But we've all had very different coaches. We've been on very different teams the last few years. And it is, I don't know, it's strange how you can do something so different but still be at a good level. And living in France last year with the Agi Desert Devo squad was another good example of that, because that... the coaching there was different, and we did, my politically correct way of putting it.
French coaching, yeah.
Yeah, we did cross-country skiing in the winter, for example. And, I mean, my numbers now are better than last year, but those guys who on the Agi Desert Evo squad, they're still bloody good bike racers. But you wouldn't say cross-country skiing is necessarily the best. I mean, it has some transferable skill, not skill.
It's very traditional.
Benefits. But yeah, it's traditional, and it's like in a very science-driven sport, you think, oh, we just ride our bikes because we're cyclists. But no, it's interesting, because I think the biggest difference last year to this year, and this sounds really cliche and I hate it, but it's true, is you ride well when you're happy. And last year I struggled quite a lot with the whole living abroad in a town where there's like three English speakers. And just, I felt very much, not immature, that's the wrong word, but I suppose it's almost like last year I was a child and now I've grown up. And the difference in my happiness level, whatever you rate that off, between last year and this year is so different, and I'm riding so much better this year. And I mean, how do you measure that? That's kind of a rhetorical question. But
yeah,
I feel there's a lot to be said for being a happy bike rider and going well.
What I say to a lot of youngsters is go to a country that suits you to race. Like, if you're not a climber, don't go to Italy. If you're a sprinter, don't go to Italy, go to Belgium. Like, if you're a big guy, go to Belgium. If you can accelerate, if you're somewhere in the middle, go to France. I went to Italy first, and that was a shock to the system. But then I say that Italy, possibly, certainly under Rod Ellingworth, Italy was one of the best things that ever happened to me, mainly because of Rod. Rod taught me how to be a bike rider, and the problem was Italy really showed my weakness at climbing. But I made the mistakes. I lost far too much weight in an effort to be good in Italy. And I guess when I did eventually go to America, I realized when I got there how much of a complete bike rider I was. And America was suddenly very well suited. Well, not just our America race program, but also the races we did in Europe. They saw that we were a bunch of big guys. You had Taylor Finney, Jesse Sergeant, myself. We were fast and we were big. So they took us to Holland and Belgium and flatter races. Whereas now, I think when they had the likes of Teo and Ruben Guerrero, they went and did Valle d'Aosta and Tour d'Alsace and these much hillier races. So that team was crucial in putting us in the right races to then turn pro from, which is what I think Axiom Bergmans does very well.
I do a little bit of coaching here and there with one or two riders, not really as a major, not as a commercial operation really. But on Training Peaks, you're saying one of the key metrics is the little smiley face you get on Training Peaks that says just how you're feeling, and the perceived exertion number that says how did it feel. And you get riders who don't bother filling that in because it doesn't seem as important as the watts and the heart rate and the speed and the Rs and the climbing and the speed of climbing. But actually, if you kind of take those numbers and track them, the correlation between how somebody's feeling just in terms of themselves generally, not just physically, and how well they go is, as you say, it's very, very close.
And it's not just, I feel it's having a life as well. Like there's almost a part of cycling where you're celebrated if you come home, you train, and you just sit on the sofa all day. And it's like, yeah, that is the best recovery method. But after like we finish chatting now, I'm going to go for a walk around Old Town. Just because if not, I've got 5 hours before I go into bed of just sitting down watching Netflix. And I've had that the last couple of hours before speaking to you. And well, some old school coaches might go, oh, well, you'll affect your 6 hour ride tomorrow by going for a 45 minute walk. And it's like, well, maybe like 0.1%. But at the same time, I'll be a lot happier because I haven't spent 5 hours just sitting inside doing nothing. I mean, I live in a beautiful place, but you can still feel very cooped up in your apartment. So, I mean, why wouldn't I go walk around Old Town?
Do you get coaching from the team?
No. Well, I'm coached by James Spragg, who's a English guy who lives in Austria. And the team kind of, they're involved, and they keep an eye on us and like on training camp, they run everything, but they're very much of the opinion, you've got your own relationship with your coach. We don't want to force anything upon you, which is quite refreshing because last year we had to be coached by the team and I didn't really see eye to eye.
I think you sometimes get a conflict of interest with team coaches because exactly. They're firstly coaching for the team and secondly coaching for you, and there will be occasions when those don't pull in the same direction.
Yeah, especially at this level, all my teammates, I'm quite close to my teammates here. I say 10 of us live in town, so you get to know each other well. But at the same time, they are my competitors. There's only X amount of World Tour contracts on offer. And when you go to World Tour, I feel you're paid to do a job. If your job is to get off after 100K, then that's your job. Whereas at our level, we're all kind of competing to be a little bit better to like attract, as we said before, attract that attention. And if you're coached by an individual away from the team, they understand that. Whereas if you're coached by the team as a whole, as you say, they're pulling in different ways sometimes.
we're going to find out over the next decade if the junior ranks is the right place to spot talent. And my guess is there's going to be some big hits and some big misses there. The one thing that I thought was fascinating was my Tour de l'Avenir, which is the under 23 Tour de France, how reflective that was of where we all ended up in the pro ranks. So even down to the smallest detail. So I went there with the GB team with Eric Rousel, Andy Fenn, Tim Kenyuk, Luke Rowe, a young Luke Rowe, myself, and maybe one more. And so if you take us, Andy Fenn had a couple of top tens and he enjoyed a few years in the World Tour and then bowed out. Luke Rowe was solid, and that's where he is in the World Tour. He was young, to be fair. Tim Kenyuk kind of didn't feature too much in the race, but I noticed that he was he was very switched on, and now he's one of the head coaches at Bahrain Victorious. Eric Rousel was a good, got round and enjoyed quite a long career on the UK scene. And I wore the yellow jersey for a day, the green jersey for a day, was second in the prologue. And then this is the sort of next part of this story is the winners and losers of that year's Tour de l'Avenir. The prologue was Taylor Finney winning, me second, Michael Matthews third. And then Taylor crashed on stage two and I inherited the yellow jersey, and which, you know, Taylor in his career, very good at time trials, also loves a crash. The sprint stage battles were a fight between John Degenkolb and Michael Matthews, and Matthews just about getting the better of John in terms of the overall for the green jersey. And Mike Matthews has won a green jersey in the Tour de France, and you would say as a sprinter has the edge on John Degenkolb. Well, I would say anyway. Talansky and Nairo Quintana were fighting for the GC win, and Quintana got the win in the end. And again, translate that into the pro ranks, and Quintana's your Tour de France contender. Talansky is very good, but just not quite at the level of Quintana.
Other than training per se, which is pretty hard to avoid if you're in your line of work, I mean, how engaged are you with the other pieces of the jigsaw? I mean, we've sort of said that you're not regarding yourself primarily as a time trialist because, you know, for perfectly sensible reasons, I think that's probably quite a small box to get yourself into, particularly if you're not an 83 kilo, 530 watt monster. But things like engineering, aerodynamics, particularly psychology, you know, is this... Are you on top of, are you across all that as well? Or is that something you kind of tend to leave to the team or ignore for the moment? Or
It depends. It depends to what levels we're talking. So in my opinion, aerodynamics, when I was junior, if you were aero and you cared about aero, you'd be on fire. Whereas these days, if you don't have the access to a big budget, I feel all those cheap stroke free aero hacks that I was doing 3 years ago, everyone's doing them now. And if I can't get into a wind tunnel, I can't get that next step ahead, which I need. And I was chatting to UAE's performance director the other day, just in town, and he was saying even someone like Gaviria was wind tunnel tested on, velodrome aero tested on training camp. Gaviria probably doesn't give a toss about time trials, but everyone in that World Tour thing is doing it now. Whereas on Axion, I mean, it's no secret we don't have the budget to do it. So while I spend however many hours kind of taping over my bolt holes, I'm at the lead, etc., etc., I can't get into a wind tunnel or onto a velodrome for reasonable money. And it's even things like, you know, you see the bars which numerous British companies put out, they're well over £1,000. Like, that's a significant percentage of my annual salary, a very significant percentage. So things like aerodynamics, I feel, unless you've got the backing, whether it's private or team, it's difficult now to be ahead of the game. Kind of things like psychology, I've actually started working with a sports psychologist this past winter, just because I struggled in France a lot last year, and little things I've started bringing in, which sounds so simple, but when you put them into effect, like in your training, or well, I haven't raced yet, but in your training, it makes that difference. And then things like diet, etc. I very much believe nobody's perfect, but if you kind of live on the whole 80%, 20% balance, or 85-15, whatever, within 85% you eat well and you live well, 15% you have a life, that's a good way of, again, staying sane.
Yeah, well, the best is that most people aren't getting it right 80% of the time, so if you get it right, yeah. I've known a lot of people who lived kind of 100%, 0%, but they could only do it for 3 weeks at a time. Yeah. And then they would go from 100%, 0% to 0%, 100% for another 2 weeks, and so on. Yeah, yeah.
And it's aero, it frustrates me a little bit, because I'm very much, say, I've grown up on the club TT scene. I was always ahead of it to a degree. And now I'm at the level where, so this Algarve TT I'm going to be doing is 20K. And I'm on arguably one of the top three fastest bikes in the world, but I haven't been wind tunnel tested. And I know in my head I'm giving watts away. But the only other way of doing it is kind of investing, I don't know, what's a wind tunnel session? £800, whatever?
Yeah, £300 an hour would do it, but
still,
you need 2 or 3 hours. So yeah, you're looking at £1,000 basically, aren't you? Because you're probably going to have to come back to the UK to do it.
And we might have 2 TTs in a year. That could be like for 30Ks worth of time trialing. And it's just balancing that up. Like if I was World Tour, I'd do it. But at the minute, I just can't afford it. And that, it kind of frustrates me. Well, it does frustrate me a lot.
I've already mentioned the heritage of Joe's team, Hagens Berman Axiom. It was set up in the late 2000s, specifically as a development team for under 23 riders by Axel Merckx, the former pro and the son of the legendary Eddie Merckx. It has been very, very successful. It's probably produced more World Tour riders than any other team, something that Joe is very well aware of. In fact, he's reminded of it on a daily basis. On the video link for this call, which unfortunately you can't see, he showed me the sleeve of his team shirt.
On video, I'm just showing you this little 39 on our side. That says 39 World Tour riders, and that's how many guys.
You need to get them to update their website, because there's 36 on the website, because I checked before I talked to you.
But 39.
39 World Tour riders in the last 12 or 13 years of the team, which, yes. I mean, the three I made a note of were Alex Dowsett, Taylor Finney, and Ben King were the first three I noticed on the list. Teo. And there's a lot more.
Teo, yeah. He's done a bit this last few months.
Yeah, he's done okay.
Yeah, not bad. Eh?
Give him
that. He's got a new coloured jersey in his wardrobe. So.
That must be the kind of thing that, from your point of view, is really inspiring, because he's not in his, what is he, 25? 24?
Yeah,
He's not that far ahead of you.
No. And the thing with Teo is he didn't go into that race expecting to win it. And if you'd have said before who's going to win the Giro, Teo probably wouldn't have been in the top 20, I don't know, 25. But he's obviously talented, and he's kind of you've got to take your opportunities again. Will he be in the same boat to win the Giro this year? Who knows? But I mean, between Teo and Jai Hindley, who were kind of odds on fighting for the Giro, you wouldn't have said at the start of the season, no way would you have said that those two are going to be like level on time going into the final stage, or even in first and second.
No.
Level on time never happens.
I mean, it was an odd season, but even so, because it's not like none of the other bike riders turned up.
Exactly.
And there was a feel there.
I remember watching it. I'd already signed. So I signed late for Axion. It was like mid-October, I think, or just, I don't know, like start of October. But it was kind of the week before or 2 weeks before the Giro finished. And I remember watching the final TT on TV at my kitchen at home, watching Teo win it. And I was like, oh, wow, like just incredible. And the thing is with his team, so it was at a training camp last week when Stuyven won San Remo. He's also like team alumni. So there's a, yeah, we've got a fair few guys who there's good footsteps to be following.
So what, why does the team do that? What is it about the team that manages to, is it like Oxford or Cambridge who produce kind of very successful alumni, but they do that for the most part by actually only letting the best in to begin with? You know, is that how, this is Axel Merckx's team, and it's been around for a while. And what's he doing that produces 39 World Tour bike riders in 12 years?
Well, I suppose that is the start of it. You can't just walk onto the team. I mean, they're not going to sign any old mug. They're not just going to, I don't know, pick 15th place on a start list and say, right, I'm signing him. A lot goes into it. But that's the same with any team. But the environment around that squad, which Axel has created over the years, it sets its own tone, I think, and the level sets itself. So on training camp, there was a couple of boys who had been on the team for the last 3 years, and they were like, right, this is how we do it. Like, we have fun when it's time to have fun, but when we're training, we train. And I think the environment which Axel has created over the last decade kind of speaks for itself. And you join Axion and you're like, bloody hell, if I wasn't already motivated, look, I've kind of, the ball's completely in my court now, because if you can't go pro out of Axion, you're not good enough. It's that simple, because the riders I've kicked out over the years, not kicked out, that's the wrong phrase.
Yeah. Produced, shall we say.
Produced over the years. That was bad slang. The riders I've produced over the years, it's just, say, 39 World Tour riders, however many Pro Conti riders. I honestly think it is, again, this is me sounding horribly cliche, it's the environment, and as much off the bike as it is on the bike.
The mentality in that team is like, work hard, play hard. And that's what we did back in 2009. We didn't have the history of the team to know that we were in such a great place to go pro. All that we knew back then is two riders would go to Radio Shack. And that was it. Those riders in that team, it'd be easy for them to go the other way and go, you know what? Like, I'm here, I've made it into the launch pad for the World Tour. And it'd be easier for some of them then to just back off, thinking it's job done. But it sounds like they know that they're very close, but they still need to put the work in to get there. But it's nice that they all sound like they want to enjoy the process as well, which I think is so important. Still to this day, the most fun year of my career was that year in Trek Livestrong. I loved it. I loved going to races. I loved racing. I loved the lifestyle. I loved the fact that we were underdogs. It was brilliant. And then you sort of get to the World Tour and it's a different kind of fun. It's far more serious. The racing's far harder. And it's different. And that's why that was the most fun year of my career. I mean, I'm glad Joe's getting to experience this. And it's nice that those boys know. I mean, those guys that are 3 years deep into the team probably know that it's kind of crunch time for them. Like, they need to have a very good year. And but it's very cool that they, like, going back to what we were talking about with your teammates being your competitors, it's cool that they say to the guys just joining the team, this is how we do things. We work hard, and when it's time to, we play hard. So, but I think it's worth noting, when I was there, like, we had a very good year. I think to date it's still the most successful year in terms of the amount of riders that then moved on. We had five went to World Tour and one went to Pro Conti. And Justin Williams was a part of that as well. And he's forged his own path and is quite the pioneer now in the cycling world, and is doing extremely well and is like very inspirational. Five of us went World Tour because five of us just did well. And so I would imagine within the team that they've kind of said there's no limit to the amount of you that can go. And they're not tied to a team anymore. Like, they used to be tied to Radio Shack. So for the first half of my year, it was like, oh, who's going to get the Radio Shack spots? But in the end, it was like, oh, well, Taylor's going to get the stagiaire and one other, I think Jesse. But actually, they're going to take Ben King and Jesse. And then BMC are going to take Tim Rowe and Taylor. Sky are going to take Alex. And Team Type 1 are going to take the other Ben King. But for the year before, they had Bjorn Seelander and Sam Bewley went to Radio Shack. And obviously, Sam is now at Mitchelton and is a sort of stalwart of the team. I mean, I guess it's kind of your Ivy League or your Oxford or Cambridge of cycling development teams.
The last year, as kind of for someone who's at a kind of such a pivotal point in your career, COVID-19 last year and this year must have been disruptive.
That's an understatement.
Yeah.
So last year I was, I think I raced once before lockdown in France. Then I went home until mid-July. And the thing is, we never knew when we were going to get started again. So it was like, when I first left, it was like, I'll see you in 2 weeks, guys. And I was just training as per usual. And then a month later, you're like, oh, well, we're not starting until July. And then a week later, it was like, oh, we're not starting until August. And there was like such a limbo period. You didn't know what to do training-wise or not training-wise. In hindsight, if I knew what I did, I'd have had a mini off-season right at the start, like just a week or 10 days. And then I came back, the season was so short. Like ours was August to September, basically. So 2 months. And then I got ill halfway through it and took 10 days off the bike. And if you get ill in a normal season, like fine, you've got another 6 months. Getting ill where I did last year, it was like day done, season done.
In terms of getting yourself in the shop window.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't.
It's really restricted.
I mean, I'm really upfront, and I know last year was awful. Like my results, they do speak for themselves. And they were bad. I probably raced 8 times last year, 7 times, and it was just apart from my first race in March, I rode really strongly. We won it. I got 5th. We got 7th, 9th. We just cleaned up. Come back in August, it was like we're just doing crits. I'm not a crit rider, so I was just like, I don't know, riding on the front, getting the brake back, calling it a day, leaving it to the sprinters. And it was just a lack of opportunities, and it was a weird racing. We saw it on the TV with the pros, but some guys were absolutely flying, but only flying for like a day, and then some guys just weren't quite up to pace. And then I was kind of somewhere in the middle. It was just a strange time. I think just because nobody really knew. Some people came out of lockdown better than others, I suppose.
Because it's that way you can't plan for it.
And yeah.
So much of performance, if you're going to perform, it's got to do with when, what event you're doing, when you're going to be doing it. And it disrupts, it just pulls the rug from under absolutely everything.
And motivation-wise as well. Like I'm not the only one who said this. Even a lot of my American teammates this year who I've only just met, they were saying there were days in lockdown, say like April, May, you're like, why the hell am I doing this? Like, I think everyone kind of had that thing in whatever they did in life. But there was a lot of guys who I was racing in March in France just never came back and then stopped racing. I think because it made everyone pause and take a look at, like take a step back kind of thing. And it was, yeah, I mean,
it seemed telling to me that when the season did kind of kick off again, the guys who were doing well were all kind of Northern Europeans, you know, Belgian and Dutch who'd been able to go outside, because all the pros in Andorra were doing kind of trying to do five hour turbo trainer days in one bed apartments up a mountain in Andorra, and they were all going crazy because they literally couldn't go outside.
That's enough to crack anyone, isn't it?
I don't know how anyone sets about doing that, even with Zwift or a Mountain View or what the hell else you've got. It's I know guys who were doing like literally 4 and 5 hours in a one bed flat.
Yeah, it's like this. Just before I moved here, actually, I had a problem with my bike, which meant I was on turbo for 2 weeks. And I think I did a 25 hour week on the turbo, including 3 6-hour rides. and I have no clue how I did it. Like, this is a really big, this is just me bragging. Like, I'm so proud of it, but I have no clue how I did it either.
That on, are you doing that in Zwift, or are you just looking at the numbers?
I was Zwift. I was actually Zoomed some guys. Okay. So we almost had like a club run on Zwift. I mean, it's interesting. Doing 6 hours on a turbo is special for anyone. And then there was one guy I was with, he was like, oh yeah, I'm doing 24 hours on turbo. I was like, oh, rather you than me, eh?
Talking to Joe and Alex really brought home to me just how much of a rider's career can be mapped out in just a few early years. In an ideal world, that probably wouldn't be so critical. But clearly, there's a relatively small window in which you have the opportunity to step everything up, from your fitness to your experience, and from your palmares to your paycheck. But there's also an awful lot that you can't control, like what sort of riders the teams are looking for. To that extent, you can only make some of your own luck. The rest of it is completely out of your hands. I'm very much hoping Joe gets the chance to follow in the tire tracks of some of the other acts, you know, boys like Tara Gegenhart, Taylor Finney, and of course, Alex Dowsett. Maybe before he's done, we'll see Joe taking a grand tour stage or two as well. Thanks very much to Joe and Alex for talking to me, and thanks to you for listening. As always, my gratitude to Cycling Weekly for their support. If you like this episode, please tell your friends about it. It really helps people find us. It'd be great if you could like and subscribe to Faster as well. You can find me on Twitter at Dr_Hutch if you want to get in touch. And if you'd like to read the book that inspired the podcast, it's also called Faster. It's also by me, and it's available from places that sell books. Faster is produced, mixed, and edited by Tom Wally and the team at Strip Media.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.